right, so I'm here today with Billy Wolf from the ACLU of West Virginia. Do you mind telling us more about yourself, Billy?
Sure. So I'm a lifelong West Virginian. I was born in Morgantown and grew up just a few miles up the road in the little unincorporated community of Pisgah, spelled P-I-S-G-A-H. And in many ways, that childhood was really a blessing. I grew up surrounded by nature. I grew up with lots and lots of pets. I've always been a big animal lover. And I grew up surrounded by this sort of very big, very loving, multi-generational family. So in many ways, that childhood was a real blessing for me. In other ways, it had its drawbacks. So I was growing up as a gay person in a pretty isolated part of the country. We didn't even have cable in my house until I was pretty well through high school. This was before the internet. This was in the 90s. And so didn't really have any LGBTQ real life role models, didn't see a lot of representation of queer people in media. Growing up, representation in media consisted of two things, pretty much: the AIDS crisis, or as sort of a punchline in a sitcom. And so it can be kind of easy in that sort of closed off environment to start to worry that you might be the only gay person in the world, or that there's very, very few of you. And how are you going to, you know, create a happy life for yourself out of that, when people would want you to think about what you were going to do with your life? It's like, well, I don't think gay people can be athletes because there aren't any. I don't think I can be a politician because there aren't any gay politicians. So in that sort of cutoff environment, you can also sort of begin to limit yourself, and your own sort of sense of self-worth can be very affected by that. So I have lived in West Virginia all my life. I've worked in news media for about 10 years, and then I sort of made the switch over to advocacy work. I worked for Fairness West Virginia for about 2 years, the statewide LGBT civil rights organization, and I'm now with the ACLU of West Virginia, where we do work on behalf of all kinds of marginalized people, including the LGBT community.
So that's, yeah, thank you for sharing all of that. So what drove the decision to go from like reporting on these issues and stories to be then like transitioning to actively like fighting to make things better and becoming, in a sense, kind of the source of like, it's like, you know, a thing in the newspaper, like a person that's featured in the newspaper. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, I think that the work that reporters do is so invaluable, and it's absolutely under attack right now by our government. I mean, the work of a free press is always, I think, a little bit under attack by the government. But we're living in really tumultuous times right now. We're living in really uncertain times, and I have been around long enough to see progress sort of move forward a bit, and I'm worried that we may be seeing it do a little bit of a backslide right now. And for me personally, when I see that start to happen, I want to be a part of any kind of movement that is advancing equality for everybody, not just for a small group of people.
Mm-hmm. And so you told us about your childhood in West Virginia. So how has your upbringing in this state influenced your activism and your drive to help make things better and progress and all that?
You're asking how my upbringing influenced my
activism.
My advocacy work?
Yep. If it has.
Well, that's a really great question. I was, I think that I was raised by very conscious and very mindful people, who wanted to, who are still, the type of people who I think are quite proud to see me, standing up sort of for what I believe in and advocating, for these marginalized communities, if that answers your question.
Yeah, definitely. So another thing that's, you know, kind of makes, you know, state news and things like that, you know, young LGBTQ people and people in general are leaving the state at a pretty high rate, especially for people who are in the LGBTQ community. Like, some people might think that this is, like, you know, it doesn't see this state as an accepting place. So why have you stayed?
That's such an important question to me. I think that a lot of queer people, maybe most of us, when we grow up in rural areas, we spend a lot of time in our childhood thinking about maybe growing up and moving to another, to a bigger city, to another country, something like that. And I had that phase, as a lot of young people do. I'm seeing a state that is not just losing population, but it's losing young, educated workforce. And that's of particular concern. So for me personally, when I think about my oldest friends, people I know going back to college, people I know going back to high school, almost all of them have gone. And a lot of them kind of think that I'm crazy for still being here. But the truth is, West Virginia's home. West Virginia is a place that I very much think is worth fighting for. I don't think anywhere else in the world would ever truly feel like home to me, and I've done a good bit of traveling. So instead, and this kind of goes back to your earlier question of, you know, why leave that journalism field for an advocacy field. I wanted to be a part of helping West Virginia change, helping West Virginia become the place that I believe it can be. The average West Virginian that I know is an incredibly accepting person. I don't think that a lot of the values that exist in our laws right now are reflective of the way the average West Virginian thinks. So at Fairness West Virginia, we helped 12 communities pass LGBT inclusive non-discrimination ordinances. In 2016, West Virginia passed more of those ordinances than any other state. So I always say there are things to be proud of. There are things to be proud of here.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, well, this will kind of lead into my next question, but a little while ago when the GOP chairperson agreed with the super homophobic anti-LGBTQ op-ed about Parkersburg Pride, I wrote a post about this, and I don't remember how many cities in the state of West Virginia have passed non-discrimination ordinances, but I pointed out, like, you have all of these cities that are starting to develop these anti-discrimination ordinances to protect the rights of, you know, queer people in the state of West Virginia. Do you happen to remember the number, by the way, of how many cities have those? Or
there are 12. Yeah, there are 12 cities, mm-hmm. And in addition to that, Kanawha County has an inclusive employment policy. So anyone who works for Kanawha County government, they also have a similar non-discrimination policy. But there are 12 communities. Charleston was the first. Charleston's ordinance is about 12 years old now. And in all of that time, 12 communities, 12 years, there have been two enforcements. So a lot of the time, the pushback against these ordinances is that, oh, it's going to create this flood of lawsuits that are going to, you know, put everybody out of business. That's not really what happens. What I believe happens, because in the time that I worked at Fairness, people would call and say, well, I was fired from my job, or I was denied a job because I'm LGBTQ. Mm-hmm. And I would ask where they live. And most all the time, they didn't live in one of these cities with a protective ordinance. Mm-hmm. And I'd say, well, there's really not a legal recourse here that we can take. But what happens is when these ordinances get passed, they make the news, and people know that this is going to be a priority now in this community, and it has the power of stopping discrimination that was already happening.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, to see that much, you know, change. You said like 12 years in 12 cities. Like, I mean, that's awesome. And also, I didn't know that Charleston's ordinance was around for that long. You said 12 years ago?
Yeah, it's been around. Charleston's ordinance has been around for 12 years, and it is trans-inclusive, which makes it especially unusual, you know, for 12 years ago for a town this size, to not only be enacting non-discrimination protections for the LGB community, but also for the transgender community.
Yeah, because I remember reading somewhere on the, I think it was the Human Rights Campaign's website, saying that there was only 22 states that had, LGBT, coverage there, and like one state just had LGB, you know, like protections.
Right.
So, for the statewide, I mean, not just counting like the ordinances or anything in towns.
Right. But what we do have to remember, though, is, 12 communities sounds like a lot. When you really look at the population figures, though, it's really only about 10% of West Virginia's population.
Yeah.
So still about 90% of the state live in areas where they can be fired, they can be denied a job, they can be thrown out of their apartment, they can be refused service in a business simply because they're LGBTQ or because someone thinks that they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so that's something that's got to change. What really needs to happen is this needs to be changed at the state level through passage of the Fairness Act, which would provide non-discrimination protections on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity.
And even on, like, the national level, I think it's October 8th, the Supreme Court will be seeing, like, I think a couple of different cases that all fall under the umbrella of LGBTQ non-discrimination sort of issues, or discrimination, I should say, because these people were discriminated against. That's why they brought it to court. But, I mean, that's coming up, like, really soon.
Yeah, so in October, and I'm not going to be able to break down each case for you, but... Mm-hmm. In October, the Supreme Court will begin hearing these cases. And there's a little bit of misreporting out there on these cases. The headlines are sometimes a little bit inflammatory, and they make it sound like the Supreme Court is going to legalize discrimination. But what the Supreme Court is actually hearing is whether or not the Civil Rights Act already covers sexual orientation discrimination and gender identity discrimination when it says that discrimination on the basis of sex is illegal. So in other words, if you're discriminating against someone because they're a lesbian, you're really discriminating against them because of their sex, because you think that a woman should be married to a man, for example, and not to a woman. And different courts have said different things on that. So even if the court goes in the wrong direction, my personal opinion is that that is a form of sex discrimination, and we should settle that now. Even if the court goes in the wrong direction on that, that's not going to overturn the states that have enacted their own specific non-discrimination laws that specifically say sexual orientation or gender identity.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
That does make sense. Yeah. I mean, like, that's like pretty different than like, it has similarities, but like, Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but there was, like, isn't there, like, there's a proposed law that wants to try to protect, like, add, like, and this is, like, not about, just a discrimination in the workplace. This is, like, adding, like, hate, it's about the hate crimes. Sorry if I'm going a little off the rails here, you know, with all these different bills and laws happening and court cases. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that with the Supreme Court case.
Sure. So when it comes to hate crimes, similar but different, right? Mm-hmm. So West Virginia has a hate crimes law.
Yes.
It specifies things like race, religion, ethnicity. It does not specify sexual orientation or gender identity. Mm-hmm. A few years back, there was a pretty high-profile case. A Marshall football player saw two men kissing on the street and got out of his car and attacked them and badly injured them. And he, of course, faced assault charges for that. But he also faced, the state also tried to bring hate crimes charges based on a similar logic that because sex is included, that he was attacking them basically out of an animus that sort of came out of discrimination based on sex, mm-hmm. in other words. And in that case, here in West Virginia, our Supreme Court said specifically, because sexual orientation and gender identity aren't listed in our hate crimes law, that this was not a hate crime. So, you know, mm-hmm. it kind of hurts for all of us to hear that because, of course, we know this was a hate crime, right? Mm-hmm. But it also shows that the state legislature needs to move to specifically adopt language that says sexual orientation and gender identity are protected from hate crimes in West Virginia. And that's a separate bill that's introduced every year at the legislature. Hate crimes and discrimination are handled in different parts of the code.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I remember back in February, it's not about hate. I mean, it wasn't exactly talking about hate crimes, but obviously similar but different scenario with, and now correct me if I'm wrong, it was back in February, I kind of forget a little bit about it, but when the House of Delegates was meeting, there was a proposal to have, it would affect all of those ordinances that had been passed, talking about discrimination against LGBTQ+ people. That's when Eric Porterfield came into it. Am I saying that right? So that way I don't have any misinformation spreading.
you're asking if the legislature was considering a bill to eliminate the non-discrimination ordinances?
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, a bill like that is introduced pretty much every session also. They haven't gone anywhere. Mm-hmm. Luckily, for the past 5 straight years, every anti-LGBTQ bill that's been introduced in the West Virginia legislature has been defeated. But yeah, those bills do come up, and it's kind of ironic, you know, because you have this sort of conservative mentality that says it wants to stress local control, but then when the local elected officials do something that they don't like, they try to come in and nullify it, right?
Yeah.
But luckily, that bill didn't see the light of day last session. I don't think it will this session either.
Okay. That's a good thing to not have to worry too much about that with this upcoming legislative session. So speaking of Eric Porterfield and recent things that have made the news with the national news, that was back in February with Porterfield, but there was, I think Melody Potter and kind of endorsed an anti-LGBTQ op-ed for, about Parkersburg Pride. I saw both things make it to the national news. I saw them both on CNN, you know, and then people of course the comments are always the same thing, you know, stereotypical things about West Virginians, all that fun stuff. How does it feel to, you know, see all of those like national news sources that reaches people across the country and across the world, like just I share these stories of these anti-LGBTQ politicians, these people in power. How does it feel to see that?
It feels awful to see that. I don't think that Melody Potter or Mike Azinger are speaking for a majority of West Virginians when they say these things. Keep in mind, Mike Azinger was opining that tolerance is bad, that to be tolerant of people who aren't like you is a bad thing. I don't know a lot of people who think such an extreme thing like that. And I've lived in West Virginia all my life. So when we sort of earn headlines like that for ourselves as a state, it's a real black eye. We are losing population at the fastest rate of any state in the country. Only a few states are losing population at all, and we're one of them. And how can we afford to keep telling people that you're not welcome here? How many more people do we want to lose? How many more people do we want to run off? I think that part of the strategy that we have to adopt to change that is to let the world know that we're welcome to everybody. We do that by passing comprehensive non-discrimination legislation.
You're exactly right there with passing these laws to help protect these people. But when it comes to news coverage, I mean, when it was announced that Tina Russell, I believe her name is running against Eric Porterfield in the next election for his position as a delegate, I didn't see that make the national news either. What do you think when West Virginians try to make things better, why do you think that doesn't make the national news while homophobic comments do?
Well, doing the right thing, you don't often get the same level of You rarely get the same amount of attention when you do the right thing as opposed to when you do the wrong thing. That's just kind of a universal truth in life. And then when we look at the fact that the news media is frankly duty bound to report on the bad stuff, what that means is you have to work twice as hard doing the right thing. You have to be twice as loud when you do the right thing so that everybody hears about it. And that is really, we're really in a position to do that right now. We're a small rural state, and we have a Republican-controlled state legislature. And neither of those things says to most people LGBT rights, right? Mm-hmm. And yet, we have our Senate president, who is a supporter of LGBT rights, and who says that he'll be, he will be bringing up legislation this year to prohibit LGBT discrimination. We have the only Senate Majority Leader, Dr. Tom Tacubo, only Senate Majority Leader who is a Republican in the whole country, who is supportive of LGBT non-discrimination and banning conversion therapy. And so if we were actually able to achieve that, that would absolutely make headlines. A small rural state with a Republican legislature passing LGBT non-discrimination really hasn't been done before. Utah passed a sort of compromised non-discrimination bill, and it does have a conservative legislature. But to actually pass something like this, I think would really shine a positive spotlight on our state. Now's the time to do it.
Absolutely. And is there anything that news, media companies can do in the meantime to, help show the people who are trying to make progress in making the state better?
You're asking about what media companies can do?
Yeah, but like, you know, people who work in the media can do. I mean,
sure.
Even what I can do.
I would often get phone calls and requests from national media organizations. And they would, we're in this kind of interesting time where Appalachia is sort of having a moment in the media. People are paying closer attention to Appalachia again. And the media is paying closer attention to LGBT issues. So there's this kind of intersection of identities there. And media would ask, national reporters would ask, like, what is the LGBTQ Appalachian experience? And it's like, well, I think that queer people in Appalachia have a very similar experience to queer people in any rural area, right? You're kind of cut off from the broader LGBT community. You're cut off from resources in certain ways. Those are the challenges that you face. And those challenges are the same in West Virginia or Kentucky, or if you're in rural New England or rural Midwest. They're very similar issues. So national media would often ask, like, what's the story that's not being told? And I would often say, you know, just shining that spotlight, there was a lot of rhetoric after the 2016 election that liberals, quote-unquote, coastal elites, quote-unquote, were sort of living in their bubbles. And so I would always say, you have a great opportunity to show people who aren't living in bubbles here in West Virginia. You know, come and do a piece on my Muslim friends who are living here in West Virginia, which overwhelmingly voted for Trump, or come and talk to LGBTQ people who live here. Come and talk to environmental activists who are living here in the middle of coal country. These are people who are interacting with the other side, quote unquote, on a regular basis. So if there's a lesson to be learned, perhaps that lesson is here in West Virginia.